Before we get to this episode, just to say thanks to everyone who's bought my new book, Champion Thinking, How to Find Success Without Losing Yourself. Published by Bloomsbury, the response has been terrific. It's an Amazon bestseller. It's been top 20 in the airport charts consistently, and the reviews have been terrific right across the board. And if you like this episode that you're about to hear on Flow, you'll be sure to enjoy Champion Thinking. Head to my website, simonmundy.com, or Amazon, Waterstone, Smith's, places like that, to get your copy.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to this bite-sized episode of Life Lessons from Sports and Beyond with me, Simon Mundy, where I seek to explore life's bigger questions. Hello, thank you for joining me again. So Wimbledon is starting today. I'll be down there working for BBC TV, so keep your eyes peeled. But the point of this episode really is to challenge the idea that winning is the only thing that matters. And in sport, and in life, it can be quite a pervasive idea. But if that was actually true, that winning was all that matters, then out of the 120 people that entered the men's and women's singles draws at Wimbledon, 127 of them would be, by definition, losers. And clearly that's not the case. Similarly, in life, the idea that if you don't reach the very top or don't change the world, you're worthless is absurd. People's value is inherent and intrinsic. And this was an idea I explored with Kath Bishop, herself an Olympic silver medalist in rowing, also a former diplomat, now author of The Long Win and a speaker. And here's what she had to say on the subject.
The belief is that anything is okay in the pursuit of an outcome, and that there are no values, if you like, that trump that. There are no considerations of what matters beyond that. It's, again, it's this narrowness that the medal all can be justified in pursuit of it. And there are lots of phrases we use in sport that now I see as really quite sinister around, you know, are you willing to do what it takes? I remember people asking me that. I remember coaches asking me that. And it was seen as a really positive thing. It's the sort of language you hear in movies, in Rocky, and, you know, how tough are you? Are you willing to do what it takes? But actually now that phrase for me is very sinister, because then there's no bar on what you might do. You get into a point where you will do anything and you want to prove that you are willing to do anything. And that's when you can get into all sorts of really compromised situations. Most obviously, you know, in some cases, in some contexts, that might mean drugs. But actually, it's pretty sinister just in a context where it means, you know, you no longer have an identity or a self-worth beyond that medal. You no longer have a sense that you matter if you don't win. And that's pretty damaging too, to any individual.
Absolutely. So in terms of your own life then, obviously you were a very elite rower. Why did you get into rowing? How and why did you get into rowing?
So I think I probably had a slightly unconventional route into sport, and that's perhaps also why I've challenged it and always felt a little uncomfortable with some of it, because I didn't really grow up as a very sporty child with all of this language being part of who I was. And I got into rowing by chance at university. I hadn't actually wanted to do it because it looked like it was really hard work and involved getting up early in the morning. So anyway, I initially didn't sign up to do it, but I got roped into it a few weeks later by people who were becoming my friends and were loving it. And there was a huge buzz and a camaraderie, and they needed an eighth person because someone had got injured for 3 weeks so they could do this sort of novice race. And I said, oh, I'll give it a go, you know, for a couple of days, see how it goes. And the lovely thing about actually joining a sport in such an inauspicious way was that I was literally thinking, am I going to enjoy this or not? Mm. I was not thinking, am I going to be good? are we going to win this novice race? Am I going to go to the Olympics? I mean, nothing could have been further from my mind that first morning, as I, you know, was obviously hopeless, as we all are when we do something for the first time. But what I did latch onto was just a real, but this is a fun thing to do. It's really different. It's challenging me physically, mentally. I liked the combination you have in rowing, where you're trying to get the best out of yourself individually, but always in a way that works with being in time with everyone around you. And then you have that sort of third layer of the environment you're in. So you're always balancing that sort of individual team and the environment piece, the water, the weather, responding to that, being alert to what that means. And I liked that sort of balancing of those three levels all the time. And I loved being on the water. I loved the feeling of the boat moving over the water. And that was always what I loved. And there were days sort of 10 years later when I was training for the Olympics when it was miserable. And it was cold and I was being shouted at and I was going slowly and I was exhausted and I was maybe a little bit on the edge of, you know, burnout. But there was still a part of me going, oh, you know, I'm probably going to retire tomorrow. I'm probably out or I'm going to be deselected tomorrow. But do you know what? I love being on the river. And it was almost like my little secret. Isn't this an amazing place to be? You know, throughout all the weather, throughout all of the year, it's what enabled me to endure, you know, some of that kind of brutality of that world. And, you know, I think certainly one expects high performance to be tough. I'm not against that at all. But I think, you know, as we've talked about, it's the sort of the belittling side of it. It's the self-esteem part. It's your identity part that you start to lose. But I'm so grateful that really what got me through and what still connects me to the sport is that I fundamentally love being on a boat on a river.
So you love the water, you love being on the boat on the river. So is it fair to say, at least in the early days, it was about then sort of exploration and enjoyment over expectation, aka outcome?
I mean, totally. Again, there was no sense of I want to go to the Olympics. There was a sort of ridiculous concept. There was a small sense that people are going, oh, you could get to the next level. You know, you could kind of get from this college boat to a university boat. And the next step was then thinking, OK, that's manageable. That looks OK. It's not that different from where I am. And also that's going to help me to develop further. So, again, you know, I love the search for the perfect stroke that you never take, that utopian perfect rowing stroke, which is going to be like the perfect forehand. Yeah. You know, you never do it. And you get hooked into that, thinking about how can I get closer to it? So that was drawing me on, the sense of, you know, how do I improve all the time? And that became the engine then that took me through the levels. And then eventually, you know, then I'm suddenly on this path to the Olympics. But at that point, it was a real shock because the culture shifted and people were literally saying to me, don't expect to have fun anymore. Now you're a serious athlete. You know that stuff at the university where you're having fun. This isn't like that. And it shouldn't be like that. So this is different. And I remember thinking, oh, I what do I know? Okay, I've got to learn to be miserable and I've got to learn to suffer more. That's good. That's a good thing. I've got to learn, you know, this sort of macho narrative that you're, you know, you're willing to do whatever it takes and the harder, the better and be the last person standing. And, you know, and if you lose, oh my goodness, it's the end of the world. You know, and I found myself like learning, oh, okay, that's the rules of this world. But actually, it wasn't helping me go faster.
That's so interesting. And that really reminds me of a conversation I had when I was working at Wimbledon last year doing the players' interviews. I interviewed Barbora Krejcikova. Now, she's from the Czech Republic, so she was a doubles specialist initially. And then she surprised everyone by winning the 2021 French Open singles title. Mm-hmm. And anyway, I think she got through to the quarters at Wimbledon and had a fascinating chat with her after the fourth round of quarters. And I asked her why she'd suddenly enjoyed this success in singles that had previously been elusive. And she said that she noticed that when she was playing mixed doubles, which tends to have perhaps be a little more or can be a little more lighthearted than, for example, doubles or singles, she noticed that when she went in there with that, well, I'm just going to enjoy this attitude. She tended to play well. So she then said, well, I'm going to transport this attitude to the singles court. And lo and behold, she went and won the French Open. So this idea that you just relayed from that you were being told about, oh, you're not going to enjoy this anymore. Not only is it unhealthy, it actually is not a recipe for success either. You know, if you're having fun, if you're enjoying yourself, if you're not obsessed and worried about, oh goodness, if I lose, my self-worth's at stake, actually, not only are you going to enjoy it more, not only are you going to have more longevity, but it's quite possible you're more likely to succeed as well.
Absolutely. And it's the shift, isn't it, from a world of fear-based motivation to exploring the joy. I think we've seen Naomi Osaka go through a similar process of getting to a place where she was just deeply unhappy. And she herself will say, I was too obsessed with rankings and I want to try and learn how to enjoy it again. And isn't that sad that you've got to a place where you've forgotten how to have fun on the court from something that you did originally fall in love with and found you had a talent for? Let me go back to this joy point, because quite often people will say, what's your favourite moment? What's the highlight of your own career? And even they might follow up by saying, you know, which medal? If you immediately, when I'm asked, you know, what's that moment of joy, I am taken immediately, instinctively, back to a couple of training camps where we're on this beautiful lake in Italy, surrounded by mountains, and the boat flies. We're in perfect synchronicity, and it feels amazing. It feels effortless, like that quote from Goldie. And, you know, I've rarely experienced this sort of joy at that level. Beautiful water, beautiful, you know, I'm in a great place physically, individually. I'm in sync with my rowing partner. We're in sync with the water. We're moving, you know, the boat is sort of at one with the water. It feels great. Absolute joy. That for me is such a special part of, you know, what I experience and what I'm grateful for. You know, you stand on a podium, usually you're dehydrated, you're exhausted. You know, there's some relief. There's this sort of sense of the aftermath of the pressure temporarily off your shoulders. It's not often pure joy. And we see that, you know, more and more. And actually, as the pressure increases, the more of a favourite you are, the less joy there is, the more you've just got that sense of, oh, thank God, the relief. And often, you know, it's people watching who experience more joy than people actually doing it. So, you know, I think it is really important to think, you know, again, you're getting something out of sport beyond that moment of the outcome. And for us to show that through the narratives, through the stories we tell, through the journalism that we use. I mean, I was actually met up with Goldie recently, and it's a great example of how when we get together, we have lots of stories that we share across our sports or moments and thinking about stories going on at the moment. We don't sit there and discuss our own results. We don't sit there and bring our medals. We don't, you know, this sense that it's all about the medals. But whenever I get together with old teammates, that's not what you talk about. That's not the stuff that you remember. Yeah. That's not the stuff you connect over. The things that made you feel alive, the things that connected you to your sport. And so why can't we transmit some of that beyond? Why do we only tell this story of the medals? You mentioned this sort of medal table piece, and I find it just getting a little dull now that we can't move away from that. And even though there's a half-hearted attempt to say it's about more than medals, what you've done is still define it in terms of medals, because you haven't defined what more than means, and you're still stuck in a medal narrative. So we seem to be unable to get out of this sort of circular narrative that in itself is a bit meaningless. So I think we won 2 medals in the Winter Olympics. We only ever are going to, you know, it's an amazing year to win 6.
Yeah.
You know, we'd have been really happy with 4. So really, is that what we're going to sit and talk about?
Yeah.
What about the incredible stories of what we saw out there? What about the integrity of athletes who did, you know, the risks that athletes took, you know, the experiences they had in these kind of death-defying sports that they're doing? There's so much out there. And there is no evidence that suggests that the British nation suffers if we win slightly less medals. You know, think about the summer, we're chasing, you know, 60 plus medals. And sure, you know, in Atlanta, we won kind of one gold medal and just a handful. Okay, that's not, that doesn't replicate, represent what our nation is capable of. I get that that's a reason to go, hang on, we can do things better. But now the sense that the nation cares, whether it's 40 or 50 or 60, I just don't get that. I think the nation cares more about the quality of the stories of the 40 or 50 or however many it is. And we don't want to see people abused along the way. And we don't want to have people coming out with mental health issues. And we need to think about the quality of the narratives we're putting out.
Thank you for listening to this episode with Kath Bishop. I hope you enjoyed it, and if you did and could share it, I'd be very grateful. Also, please do get in touch with any thoughts via my website, simonmundy.com. Until next time, goodbye.